What's Grace Fellowship all about? What really keeps us going? And where are we going? This year we've been looking at the big rocks that our church is built on. We've stopped to unpack our vision statement again so that we'll know why we do what we do. And we're using the illustration by Stephen Covey of the rocks in the jar to remind us that if we don't keep in mind what are the big rocks, what's most important and put it in first, we'll never get it in after all the other stuff that everyone thinks is so important, must have, must do, the laundry list of things that churches are doing. Why don't we such and such? Oh, Brad, I know another church that does this. We ought to. If we don't know what our big rocks are first, we'll be all over the map. And later say, oh, this is really important, but how do we get it in? How do we fit it now with a full program? We want to keep our big rocks in place and keep reminding you what they are. So we've looked at six rocks so far this year. Today I want to pick up the seventh rock and examine another rock, the rock of worship. And not just any kind of worship. You see, we're committed to a particular kind of worship here at Grace Fellowship Church, and I hope you've sensed that. We are not a purpose-driven church. In our worship, we want to be God-driven. God-driven. God-focused worship. We may not be the best band, the best musicians, the best singers, the best sound system, but we hope that we're striving to be a place where when you leave, you'd say, the worship was focused on God. Not any super singer, not any super instrumental player, not a lot of songs about us and our needs and our problems, but God. 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 God-focused. So we want to put the emphasis on God in our worship. The seventh big rock is God-focused worship. And that's by design, and it's on purpose. And it weeds out a lot of music, a lot of songs that might be good or catchy or moving. We don't use them if it's not God-focused. If it doesn't direct us. And here's our big themes, if you haven't picked them up. The glory of God, the grace of God, the cross of Christ, and the sovereign rule of God. Those are our big themes that we love to expound and proclaim. And that will change the way you think. And that will change the way you see whatever you came in here with. The problems that you'll have, the people that you'll have, the job that you'll have may not have changed at all. But our desire is that you will have changed and you'll see it differently and you'll think differently because God has been put back in the picture. It's not that even so much you need something removed. So many of us constantly think, if just this was gone out of my life, if just this was absence, if just this was reduced. You know what most of us need? The very same plate we've got, plus God. More of God. More of God framed in the picture. Too often, God is in the margins of our lives, and people and problems are right in the center frame. That's what we're focused on. That's what we're emphasizing. That's what we're dwelling on. And God's out here. We want our worship to be something that at least once a week would bring God back into the frame. Center frame. Centerpiece. And change the way we think and respond, make decisions. See, we're not interested in having a music ministry here. We want worship. There's a difference between music and worship. We want worship. We're asking God to ignite a flame of worship and keep it burning in our midst week after week after week after week. Worship. Genuine worship. Not just music, not just songs, but worship. So let me give you this morning four reasons that one of our rocks is God-focused worship. Four reasons for emphasizing and clinging to and promoting and preserving and protecting God-focused worship. See, a lot of people sometimes, and I hope this doesn't hurt your feelings, but maybe it's time to say it again so that you'd know. I got a couple daughters playing the piano, and different people sing, different people do different things. From time to time, someone will ask, you know, can my little so-and-so play the piano, or can I sing a solo? We're just not interested in that, because when that happens, I'm not saying it's a sin, it is very hard for that not to become your moment, your singing a solo. We just don't do it that often, because we don't want anyone here to have a moment other than God. Here's the other thing that happens, is when you do a lot of special stuff up here all the time, the crowd out here tends to just kick back and think, wow, I guess we're just supposed to watch them do it, because they do it so well. We don't want that to happen. When we gather for worship, we want to ignite you. You're the choir. You're the praise team. You're the soloist. You're the special music. So some people have asked, when we get in the new building, will we have a choir loft? No. Will we do solos during the offertory? No. We're not going to change. By design, what we're doing is still what we're going to do. And I'm not saying someone else that does it differently is wrong. You'll see places in the Old Testament where there was a cantor, or someone sang, and someone did stuff. But churches have to make decisions. And we've made one decision that we're so jealous for God's glory. And like it or not, folks, this whole area of music so easily can feed the flesh. It so easily becomes a place where someone, I have to say to myself, how much do they love God and how much do they just love singing? I love singing. I love to sing. Can I sing a solo next Sunday? Talk to me about how much you love God. There can be a love for music, even among Christians, that shadows and overshadows and squeezes out God. God. We want God-focused worship. Here's four reasons. Reason number one, we're committed to God-focused worship because God-focused worship is what we think will best connect you to your ultimate purpose for living, and that's the glory of God. Your ultimate purpose for living is the glory of God, and we think God-focused worship can best connect you to that purpose and bring you back time and time again. Some people live their entire lives without grasping that the purpose for living is the glory of God. That's my purpose for living. That should be what gives me significance. Right here in worship, week after week, we hope you'll have a visible and poignant reminder that calls you back. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. That we're to glorify God, display His splendor, reflect His goodness. Isaiah 61:3 is a great passage that brings us back to that. It says in Isaiah 61:3, to bestow on them the crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of sadness, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness. We are to be oaks of righteousness. And then the next phrase, He's going to tell us why. So that everyone will think we're so strong and so tough and so sound and so... Next phrase tells us, and it starts with the preposition for the display of His splendor. I've said it before, I don't want to be a sapling. I don't want to be an ornamental pear tree. I'm sure we lost some ornamental pear trees last night in neighborhoods. They look great, but the first strong wind, they're gone. No root system. He doesn't want us to be saplings that are blown over. He wants us to be oaks of righteousness, but watch out. It's not for your glory that you're the oak that's left standing while all the ornamental pears go down. Oaks of righteousness for the display of His splendor and glory. That's our purpose. That's why we do what we do. That should be why you do what you do. Not just me as a pastor, plumber, carpenter, engineer, doctor, attorney, student, homemaker, mother, wife, father, mechanic. For the glory of God, you should connect who you are and what you do to the glory of God. Every single one of you as believers. You be the best mechanic, best attorney, best mom, best dad, best for the glory of God. You fix that car like it's God's car. You take care of that legal case like it's God's legal case and that He's watching, and He is. For the glory of God, the glory for the display of His splendor. We're committed to God-focused worship because we think God-focused worship connects you back to your ultimate purpose for living and gives us a reminder week after week after week. We're not here trying to build our own kingdom, our own empire. We're not trying to make a name for ourselves. This is not the Tower of Babel part two. That's not what it's all about. We're not here to set denominational growth records. We're not the biggest, brightest, best. We're here for God's glory. For almost 9 years now, in May, we'll be 9 years old. I believe God raised up Grace Fellowship in Northern Kentucky to display His glory. And if we ever forget that and we start thinking that we're the biggest, the brightest, the best, He will cut our legs out from under us and we'll be just one more church or we won't exist. It's not about us. It's not that we're doing things so right. It's not that we've read a lot of church growth books. It's not any of that. It's the pleasure of God. It has pleased God to bless Grace Fellowship, and I think He has. But don't dare let pride begin in the way or us begin to get in the way of saying, look at us. That we would begin to lead seminars and show others. We don't want to lead anything or show anybody anything. We want, if we lead anything, it'll be leading them to God and say, look what God has done. Look what God has done. Look what God has done. Deflect, deflect, deflect. If we ever start absorbing and owning any of this praise, we're in big trouble. Deflect, deflect, deflect. Thank You, Lord. Look what You're doing, Lord. Look how You have led us. Look at Your faithfulness. This world desperately needs to see more than anything else the glory of God.
The glory of God. The hurting world around us needs to see more than anything else the glory of God. They don't need to see one more well-run church that's modeled after a business model. They don't need another coffee bar. They don't need another food court. They don't need another family life center. They need to see the glory of God. And I'm not saying it's a sin to have any of that. We may have coffee in the lobby. I don't know. One day may have a family life center. But when you start to think those things are what's going to make it, we're going to reach seekers because we have cappuccino. We're going to reach seekers because we have volleyball now. Folks, if God doesn't move on the heart of a person, volleyball won't get it. Cappuccino won't get it. The glory of God is what they're hungry for, and they don't know it. I know they're asking for cappuccino. They're asking for volleyball. And you need to say, I hear you saying glory of God. Yes, we'll give you that. Cappuccino. Oh, glory of God. They don't know that's what they want, but they want that. Starbucks can give them better coffee than we can. Health South and Better Bodies can give them a better gym. Let's give them the glory of God. The glory of God. That's what people desperately need to see and to be connected to. John Piper says, we're all starved for the glory of God, not self. No one goes to the Grand Canyon to increase self-esteem. Why do we go? Because there's greater healing for the soul in beholding splendor than there is in beholding self. We got a world right now that is obsessed with beholding self. And they're being told, turn inward, turn inward, turn inward. Look at yourself, your inner child, your inner wounds, your little child, your this, that, and the other, your memories and healing memories. And it's all a mess. We need to draw them outward and upward. Outward and upward. It's not inward. Not self. They need splendor. And they need more than the Grand Canyon. It would be like someone, you know, people are struck by creation. I'm thankful for that. And God says in Romans chapter 1, that's the purpose. Creation declares His glory. Psalm 19 says that. And Romans 1 says, it declares His glory. But creation is just a shadow. A shadow of the real thing. It'd be like me sitting in the house and you come by the house and you find Vicky out in the yard in the chair sitting by herself and I'm inside the house and you find me with a photo of Vicky oohing and aahing over the photo, talking to the photo, enjoying the photo. And you say, well, Brad, Vicky's out in the yard. I said, I know. I just love the photo. That's really what's going on when people say, I just want the mountains, the rivers, the hills. That's where I worship. That's what moves me. When they say that, they're just seeing a dark image, a shadow, a photo of the real thing. That's supposed to whet their appetite and cause them to say, where did this come from? What's behind this? Give me the real, living, color version. Who could have done this? Glory of God. The glory of God. The glory of God. We're here to bring you back, I hope and I trust, to the glory of God and the gospel of Christ, His Son Jesus. There's where you see in a large way demonstrated the glory of God. 2 Corinthians 4, 3 and 4 says, but even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. Now here's what He doesn't want them to see. What does the God of this age not want anyone to see? What's He trying to blind them from? He tells us, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. Folks, I believe that is why Satan is so relentless in undermining and attacking the person of Jesus Christ. Like The Last Temptation of Christ in other movies, and defecation and urine of Christ in the cross in a jar. Relentless with attacking and undermining the person of Christ and belittling the person of Christ. Because Satan does not want us to see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. The glory of Christ, who is the very image of God. That's what Satan wants to keep suppressed. And that's our job and our calling to promote the glory of God in the face of Christ. We want our worship to be a laser beam of light that pierces the fog of our own selfish concerns that we bring in here every week and illuminates the glory, the beauty, the splendor of Christ. We want our worship to call us back. Since the world barks at us all week to turn inward, to turn inward. It's our problems, our successes, our goals, our dreams, our hurts, our agenda. The glory of God calls us out of the tunnel of our own selfish delusion and into the light of something bigger, much bigger connects us to something bigger, so that you can live for something bigger. The problem that people have today in their misery, and they don't know why they're so depressed and so unhappy and so frustrated and irritable when they live in the most prosperous country with the most opportunities and options available, is that they're living very small lives. Listen to me. The smallest life you can live is one you live for yourself. And our culture has made an idol out of self, supposedly to help us get over the hurts, because we've been so hurt, it's time to take care of you. It's time to protect you. It's time to be concerned about you. And it's only made it worse. The smallest life you can live. You want walls to start closing in and the ceiling to start feel like it's coming down? You start living just for yourself. He tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:15, He died for all, that those who live, those who really live now, you've got life in Christ, here's how you should live, that those who live should no longer live for themselves. No longer live for themselves, but for Him who died and rose again. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says that whatever you do, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Glory of God, glory of God. He says in Isaiah 43, 6 and 7, bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Everyone who's called by my name, every human being, everyone who's called by my name, whom I created for what? For my glory. Whom I created for my glory. If He created you for His glory and you never get connected with that purpose, will you not be frustrated the rest of your life? Absolutely. And people are searching and hunting through dance clubs and bars and job and working and hobbies and sports and sex and immorality and can't find what they're looking for because they don't want to look towards God at all. They're so afraid that will be so limiting and so crippling and so burdensome to have God in my... Oh, no, 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 not God. But the glory of God is what they desperately need. Whom I created for my glory. For my glory. We're committed to God-focused worship because we think God-focused worship best connects you back to your ultimate purpose for living, the glory of God. Second reason that we're committed to God-focused worship is we believe that God-focused worship is the most life-changing worship. See, we don't want to just sing songs. We don't want just loud music. We don't want to just jump around. Just like we've been talking and saying that we are determined and committed to see changed lives, our worship fits that same category. Nothing different going on here. We don't worship just to worship. See, sometimes it's too easy to get caught up in worship, and you can worship worship. Do you know what I'm saying? We love worship, and we forget who it's all about. It's like having a birthday party, some special party for a baby that you've just adopted or christened or something, and the baby gets laid in the bedroom in the back, and as all the guests come in the door, everyone keeps going back there and laying their coats on the bed, and pretty soon the little baby laying on the bed is covered up with the coats of the guest, and we're all in the living room laughing and carrying on, and that's the guest of honor. That's what we're doing sometimes when worship begins to be worshiped. We want worship to move us to God. 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 We're committed to God-focused worship because we think it's the most life-changing. That it would change us when we see God. We want to be changing and growing. I think of Isaiah chapter 6. This is the kind of response we want in worship. And I know we don't get it every week. I know you could score us on the way out and say, I wasn't moved. Nothing moved me. I didn't like any of the songs. We're not trying to please you. But that's not the point. Our desire in Isaiah 6 is to see this. To see this. Isaiah said in Isaiah 6, in the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and lifted up. And the train of His robe filled the temple. And above Him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And they were calling out to one another, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty! The whole earth is full of His glory. And the doorposts shook at the sound of their voices, and the temple was filled with smoke, and I cried out, Woe is me. That was Isaiah's response. Not, Woo, this is good worship. I like that song. I like what they're singing. No, the response was, Woe is me, for I am undone. Undone. Unhinged. Unraveled. I'm undone. For my
For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. He was conscious of his sin. Conscious of his sin. By having been in the presence of God, high and lifted up, he was conscious of his sin. Woe is me, for I'm undone. See, as undone as we feel, most of the focus today is, if you were to interview people or ask people, we're stressed out, we're overwhelmed, it's over our heads, we can't do anymore, we're undone. We think we're undone. We're not as undone as he'd like us to be. We come in much more together than God even wants us to be. He wants us to be undone in his presence. Stop keeping that image. Stop thinking you can do it. Stop cruising along and hammering with your agenda and what you want and where you're going and what you're doing. Undone. Genuine God-focused worship shatters us and puts us in our place. Puts us in our place. That's the starting point for real change. Until you really see who you are in light of who God really is, you're not a candidate for change. Not much can happen. You continue to believe your own lies and your own delusions and your own thinking. And genuine God-focused worship can take the walls of our world and explode it and expand it. You can sing songs, play loud music, jump around, but that doesn't change lives until you've come into God's presence and seen Him and been undone. God-focused worship leads to personal transformation. Because, look at the Scriptures. Look at the examples of where people had face-to-face encounters with God. You don't really see God and stay the same. Now, can you be all around the fringes of it? Can you be near it? Absolutely. Look at Christ. He lived on the earth for those 33 years and spoke and taught. And there were some that still didn't get it. And they were close by. But those that really saw Him were undone. They were shattered. I think of Peter in the boat when Jesus said, go out one more time and throw the net over the side of the boat and give it another shot. He could hardly even haul the fish in. And there was a very odd response to that. Instead of saying, whoa, I'm going to make you part of my regular fishing team, Christ. Join the team. He said, depart from me. Get away from me. Depart. He's hauling in this huge load of fish and he says to Christ, depart from me. Get away from me. What happened? He saw Christ for who he really was and it made him see himself for who he really was. He was undone. He was undone. And it changes you. It changes you. God-focused worship, we believe, is the most life-changing worship. Ben Patterson, in his book on prayer that I've mentioned a couple weeks ago, said, no character in the Bible found anything approaching a face-to-face encounter with God anything less than shattering. We must learn to act and think as people who are amazed at our proximity to holy things and that He's not left us vaporized. Okay. We must pray that God will cultivate in our spirits fresh awareness of His majesty and goodness and that we not confuse His goodness with His being safe. Like the lion Aslan in C.S. Lewis's The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. He isn't safe, but He's good. Now when you hear me say that, and when C.S. Lewis said that, he didn't mean you couldn't trust Him. What it means is, watch out. He's good, but He's not safe if you don't want Him messing with your life. If you want to stay exactly how you are and you don't want anything messed with and you want it to be your agenda, then don't get close to God because He's all about changing us and changing what we're wanting and changing where we're going and changing what we're thinking. So He's not safe. That's not safe. Most of us don't like change. We don't like the agenda being turned upside down. We don't like surprises. And God is full of surprises. He's not safe. He's good. He's good. Annie Dillard playfully suggested in one of her books that along with Bibles and vestments, we should wear crash helmets when we worship. Because God just might show up. Huh? There's a different thought. That God just might show up. We ought to have crash helmets on. What if He showed up? What if He really showed up? That's our desire, that we would encounter God. Not just brush up against good music, not just brush up against one another in encouraging remarks, but God, that you would have gotten out of bed, set your alarm, got the kids dressed, done breakfast, done all the difficult things you did to get here, not to just hear music, not to just see one another, but to encounter God. God, the presence of God, and to be shattered. 2 Corinthians 3:18 says, but we all with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed. Changed from glory to glory, just as from the Lord, the Spirit. God-focused worship
changes you. Because it stirs you up and keeps alive the ongoing process of weaning us from the world and wedding us to Christ. Weaning us from the world and wedding us to Christ. More and more and more and more and more. Change. We want our worship to prod you and provoke you to go further with God. If you're sucking wind, and if you're starting to flag, and if your vision of God has gotten crusted over and fogged over, and you're just not seeing quite as clear anymore, we want our worship to be something that wipes the windshield of your life one more time, and you can see again. You say, ah, okay, I go on. That it would prod you and provoke you to go further with God. And that it would prod you and provoke you to take that little sin that you think is so important and so all-consuming that you can't live without, and lay it down. And say, this isn't worth it. And to delight and hunger for and go hard after God. 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 And that's one of the purposes that I think we need to gather together. Because if God, Satan can get us isolated on our own and get me stuck in my own sorry thinking, I'm much more at risk. And if we can come here together, and I sense others of you delighting in Him, even though maybe this week I wasn't, He was way up far from my mind, that has an effect on me. The sweet aroma of the knowledge of Christ in you, I smell it, and I need it many weeks. I need to get around the sweet aroma of the knowledge of Christ. And to see others going hard after God, and delighting in God, and reveling in God, and glorying in God. We think God-focused worship is the most life-changing worship. So we're committed to it. Committed to God-focused worship. Reason number three is God-focused worship. We're committed to this because it's the most satisfying and agitating. It has the most satisfying and agitating effect on us. That may not be the best word. I struggle to decide how to communicate this. But here's what I'm trying to say. In worship, we want you to have a sense of being, oh, satisfied in God, and at the same time, want more. That you're agitated. It stirs you up. That you don't have enough. You want more. That's not enough. That's not enough. That's not enough. We want it to be both satisfying and agitating. That it would stir you up to want more of God. Psalm 16:11 says, "You'll make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures forevermore." In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures evermore. Not in the pornography, not in that paycheck, not in that bonus, not in that job promotion, not in the award that your son or daughter just got. In His presence is fullness of joy. All those other things fade. All those other things pale. The glory of God and the pleasures of God. Here's the neat thing about God and His pleasures. His pleasures have no expiration date. They don't go bad. They don't get stale. Doesn't that bum you out when you pull something out of the... I pulled out of the cabinet just the other day, found it in a basket stuck way down in the bottom. I found some candy. And I was excited. Chocolate candy. And so I began to salivate, and my stomach was getting excited, and I'm peeling the wrapper off and popping it in my mouth. Hard as a rock. No good. No good. That's not going to be the case with any of God's pleasures. No expiration date. They don't go bad. You're not going to go there and say, the pleasures of God. In Psalm 36, 7 and 8, he says, "How precious is your loving kindness, O God. Therefore, the children of men put their trust under the shadow of your wings. They are abundantly satisfied with the fullness of your house." Now, start taking notice as you read your Bible, the extreme adjectives that God uses when He talks about what He'll do for us. Fullness. Fullness. Fullness of joy, Jesus talked about. Satisfied, not just satisfied, abundantly satisfied in the fullness of your house. And you give them drink from the rivers of your pleasures. We're committed to God-focused worship because we know how often we're guilty of drinking at the broken cisterns of the world that don't satisfy. And you come in here with your heart and mind and soul all clogged up with the mud and the filth and the silt of the world. And we hope that worship will be something that will flush out your heart and get the rivulets of your heart flowing again with fresh, satisfying thoughts of God and His presence and His power and His promises. God and His presence and His powers and His promises. Because listen, when you walk out that door and you get in your car, everything outside in our culture is designed to clog up those channels in your life. Clog them up.
Clog them up. The pace of life, the trials of life, the difficulties of life, and the wrong thinking that's served up to us. Turn inward, turn inward, turn inward. It clogs us up. And here's a place to have a flush, a heart flush, and get the rivulets of our heart flowing again with satisfying, fresh thoughts of God and His presence and His power and His promises and His character and His faithfulness.
It's worship.
Because of how often and how desperately we need to be reminded of who our God is and how big our God is. Who our God is and how big our God is. By nature, as life grinds on. And listen, see if this is not true. By nature, as life grinds on, we tend to see people and our problems as bigger and bigger and bigger. All the while God gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Most people today, sadly, it includes Christians, think they have giant problems and a pygmy God. They wouldn't tell you that. They wouldn't shake my hand and say, "Good morning, we've got a small God. Good morning, He's a pygmy. Good morning, He's a dwarf." But the life that they're living and the theology that is being showed, not with their lips, but with their life, is saying, "I have a small God. I have a small God. He's a dwarf. He's a dwarf. He's not helping me much at all." That's what the life is saying. That's what the choices are saying. That's what the thinking is saying and the conclusions they're drawing. My problems and other people around me are giants. My God is small. We sing about a big God. I read about Him in the Psalms, but I don't see that in my life. I don't experience that in my life. That's just not true in my life. Because of sin, we tend to dwarf God and magnify our problems in other people. And it leads to all kinds of pitfalls and snares filled with fear, anxiety, worry, greed, anger, lust. So much of the sin that we get into is a result of not having a proper perspective of God. It's not just that the sin is so attractive. That's why I appreciate John Piper's definition of sin so much. Sin is what we do when we're not satisfied in God. You don't need to run from pornography any harder than maybe you already are. You need to get to know God better and be drinking it His pleasures and His will more deeply. And pornography wouldn't be so attractive if you knew how good it was in God's presence and what He had to offer. It's a twofold approach. Not just run from sin, run to God, into His presence, and start drinking from His well and not so much from the broken cisterns. And when you start to get your thirst quenched and satisfied and refreshed, you say, "Why did I ever go there? Why did I ever look to that? Why did I ever think that would satisfy?" It's like looking through the wrong end of a telescope. Look at me. As you come in here each week, not only do you get a bulletin, but you get an opportunity to stop. We want our worship to be something that makes you stop and check and see if you've been looking at life and your God through the wrong end of the telescope. If literally each one of you had a telescope, I guarantee you, at least half of you, as you walked in here, would have had it turned in the wrong direction. You're looking through the wrong end of the telescope at your God, and He's been dwarfed. And you're spinning that around, and every time you talk about your problems, and the issues, and the people, you're looking at it through the right end, and they're huge. And God's tiny. And they're huge. And you've reduced God to nothing more than a pocket-sized lucky charm. It's not really worth turning to, or going to, or knowing, or delighting in. This is an opportunity. God-focused worship, we hope, will stop you in your tracks and get you to check out your telescope and say, "Have I been looking at it through the wrong end?" Like the song we sang, to be magnified, not minimized. For some of us, we'd have to say, "Be minimized, oh God." We minimize Him with our thinking and our approach and our perspective. And along with that songwriter, we should sing, "Too long. Too long have I thought wrong. I've made You too small in my eyes. Oh Lord, forgive me. And I have believed in a lie, that You were unable to help me. But now, oh God, I see my wrong. Heal my heart and show Yourself strong. And in my eyes and in my song, oh Lord, be magnified." Now, with that perspective, you can have the same health report from your doctor, the same pink slip telling you they don't need you in that job position anymore, the same son or daughter with the same poor grades, the same car that isn't running, the same notice of eviction from where you're living, the same, and feel different about it. I'm not advocating a stick our head in the sand and we'll pretend everything's good and just because you know God, problems don't hurt. You can still cry over that daughter or son. Still cry with your spouse over that health condition. Still do what is normal in emotions, but you don't fall so deeply into that pit with a pygmy God. God, magnified, goes with you in the pit. And you see Him as big. We need to see God in the problem, not outside of the problem. See God in the problem. Frame Him in the problem with you. One of the things I appreciate so much about the story of Joseph in Genesis, many things, but one of it that I've circled in my Bible is three times through those chapters. And this was a long time for this young man, from about age 17 to about 34. That's a long time. To say, God, this isn't good. What about the dream where I was going to be used? What about the dream where everyone else's little sheaf loaf was going to bow to me? Three times it says, but God was with Joseph. You can put your name in there. But God is with Diane. God is with Tony. God is with Janelle. God is with Steve. God is with. Put God in the problem. See God in the problem. He hasn't abandoned you. He hasn't left you. And He is sovereignly. You didn't fall into those circumstances. God sovereignly, as a good, wise, loving, all-knowing shepherd, led you into that. He led you there. He leads us. He doesn't hurt us. He doesn't bark orders ahead. He doesn't get distracted and we end up... He leads us. Yea, even into trials and trouble. There's a false theology that says God is so good and so loving, He only wants good for you. He only wants health. He only wants you to get promoted in your job. That is not biblical. God lets His children and leads His children into losing jobs and getting cancer and getting difficulties and having rebellious children, and He is still glorified in the difficulties. Many times more so than in the good times. God is sovereign. See God. Now, don't hear me saying we pin blame on God and God is the author of evil or the originator of sin. Oh no, we own that. And other sinners around us own that. And they'll be responsible for what they've done against you. But a sovereign God orchestrates all that. And some puny human being did not do to you something God didn't want to happen. Now, I know that's hard when it bumps up against things like rape and abuse. That is the teaching of Scripture. As hard as that may sound right now, that's one of the most comforting things I could tell you. Otherwise, if that was a person's doing and God couldn't stop it, let's sing, "Oh, be minimized, oh God." What kind of God is that? If He couldn't stop it, where was He? He's right there. He's right there with you now. Whatever you're going through, He's right there. We're committed to God-focused worship because of how often and how desperately we need to be reminded of who our God is and how big our God is. To get our telescope turned back around in the right direction. Every single one of us needs a steady dose of wonder that's kept alive by worship. Worship keeps wonder alive. It keeps wiping the film off of our lives. Worship is the spiritual IV that needs to be dripping in our soul every day to keep us from crusting over with infection and hardening up with sin's deceitfulness. Worship. Worship. Dripping in our souls because wonder is kept alive by worship. I love how the British author G.K. Chesterton illustrates this. Our great need for worship and yet how hard it is to keep wonder alive as you get older. And he uses this illustration. He says, imagine yourself telling a story to three children of three different ages. And you tell the very same story. And I can relate to this because we have five young children. So I want you to enter into this as I apply it to three of ours. Kelly is 9 years old, our daughter Kelly. Garrett is 7, and Sarah Grace is 3. Now what if I told each one of these children the same story? And I want you to listen to the simple story as it reaches its climax. I say to Kelly, our 9-year-old daughter, Kelly. Little Tommy got up, walked up to the door, and opened the door. When he did, an orc jumped out in front of Tommy. Kelly would draw back and her eyes would get wide until I assured her that Tommy whipped the orc. To Garrett, I say, Garrett, who's 7. Garrett, little Tommy got up, walked up to the door, and then with my voice hushed and speaking each word slowly and deliberately, I say, and little Tommy opened the door. Garrett's big blue eyes would just get wide as he anticipated what lies behind that door. Now, with our youngest, Sarah Grace, who's 3 years old, you got to understand, for Sarah Grace, her whole worldview is exhausted by the thought of going somewhere in the van with the rest of the family. That's the apex of life. That's about as good as it gets at 3. You know, one of her number one questions to us, and I think it's interesting, number one questions. You know, there's 7 of us. We have 5 children, a mom and a dad. There's 7 of us around this table when we eat meals together. Just talking, carrying on. You know, where we've been, where we're going, someone that's having us over, Kings Island, when we're going on vacation, when we're going to see grandparents. And you can just see the wheels turning in her high chair as all this is going back and forth. And she's looking for a break in the conversation. When one happens, inevitably, here's her comment. Will I be there? Will Sarah be there too? Sarah be there too? Will I be there? Will I be there? Well, now she's learned to ask that because she's found out half the time she ain't there. What? All that you heard about, you aren't going to see it. You won't be there. You know, most of her life she realizes all these things we talk about, they never come to pass in my life. I haven't seen Kings. I don't see these things. Whatever happens to any of these things we talk about? Sarah be there? Will I be there? So now for Sarah, you got to understand, I lean down and just me leaning down and just me saying her name. Sarah? Eyes light up. Her little cheeks pudge up underneath her eyes. She's already excited. Sarah, little Tommy got up and walked up to the door. Her eyes are already laughing with delight, and her face is beaming. Now, do you understand what's going on here? For Kelly, at 9 years old, she needed the orc to evoke wonder. At 7 years old, for Garrett, just opening the door slowly struck a chord for him. For 3-year-old Sarah, just walking up to the door, just being there, was exciting. I'm there! I'm there. I'm at the door. I'm with everybody else. That's exciting. And G.K. Chesterton says this. Here's the point. The older you get, the more it takes to fill your heart with wonder. And only God is big enough to do that. The older you get, the more it takes to fill your heart with wonder. As we recognize that, that's why we purpose to have God-focused worship. To fill your heart with wonder. We want to fill your heart with wonder because we know you're getting cynical, caustic, sarcastic, glossed over, hardened. The older you get, the more it takes to fill your heart with wonder. And we're convinced one more ripping instrument and banners and streamers, and if we run up and down the aisle, that may get your attention one week. But to fill your heart with wonder, we know we've got to tilt your head back and turn you to God. 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 We're committed to God-focused worship because of our desperate need and how often we need to be reminded of how big God is and who He is. I want to close with 2 quotes, one from Eugene Peterson and one from Ben Patterson. Eugene Peterson says, "Very often when I've left a place of worship, the first impression I have of the outside world is how small it is, how puny its politics, paltry its appetites, squint-eyed its interests. I've just spent an hour or so with friends reorienting myself in the realities of the world, the huge sweep of salvation, the minute particularities of holiness, and would blink my eyes in disbelief that so many are willing to live in such reduced and cramped conditions. But after a few hours or days,
I find myself getting used to and going along with its assumptions, since most of the politicians and journalists and artists and entertainers and stockbrokers and shoppers seem to assume that this is the real world. And then Sunday comes around, and a pastor calls me back to reality. Let us worship God. And I get it straight again. I see it whole. Peterson concludes by saying this: every call to worship is a call into the real world. Now, I like that. Not just because I'm a pastor, because I've heard that so often. You finish something wonderful in the presence of God, with the things of God, where you feel like everyone has been tasting and seeing that the Lord is good, and someone says, oh, but isn't it sad that we've got to go back into the real world? As if this was make-believe. We all just had a Mr. Rogers neighborhood time, and now we're going to go back to the real stuff. And that this really has nothing to do with that. But it's a nice diversion and amusement. So wrong. You just had an opportunity to see the real world, because out there it blinds us from the realities of what's most important that you don't see. Penn Patterson says something similar when he says, occasionally I hear something like this after a great service of worship: that was wonderful. Too bad we have to go back to the real world now. The assumption seems to be that what happened in worship was a pleasant and therapeutic diversion, and that the real thing is out there in the rough and tumble of the world. It's the other way around. What was seen and felt in worship is the real thing. The secret is to remember what we saw and felt when we go back into the world of deception and lies. That's our desire. God-focused worship that would help you to see the real thing one more time. The real thing, so that you not lose heart. And the real thing will bear on all that you do out there, and the way you see it, and the way you respond, and whether you'll lose heart or not, or whether you can keep going. Only a vision of God and the glory of God is big enough to keep you going. Let's pray together.